We're delighted to have as our third speaker our American friend, Matt Schlabaum, who's the coordinator of the Maine Trade Free Trade Campaign. The Maine Free Trade Campaign is a statewide coalition of 40 organizations working to promote fair trade policies in a more just, sustainable, and democratic local and global economy. Since graduating from Bates College in 2000, Matthew has worked with several organizations in Maine on issues of economic justice, undoing racism, and forest protection. He has served as coordinator of the Fair Trade Coalition since 2003. He lives in Green, Maine. Please welcome Matt.
It's great to be here. And it's great to see such an inspiring large crowd. We don't have crowds like this in Maine. It's good to see these faces. So I do work for the Maine Fair Trade Campaign. We're a statewide coalition. And I want to talk a little bit about why I'm here. I think a lot of, you know, I talked to a few folks in the media beforehand, and they said, why are you here from the U.S.? What does the U.S. have to gain from opposing Atlantica or being engaged in all this? And you know, I think it's pretty clear in my mind. It's because this model, this NAFTA model, has been devastating to the majority of people in the U.S. I think there's a common, you know, we sort of lose sight of the fact that, you know, that the majority of people are losers under this model, right? It's elites in the U.S. and elites in Canada and elites in Mexico who have won under NAFTA and who have won under this neoliberal economy that they're building. But the majority of people have lost. And yes, you know, the U.S. is filled with hypocrisies when it comes to trade and the softwood lumber dispute. But it's crucial that we not mix up the American population, the American people, from the elites, the owning class, the ruling class in the U.S. that really has benefited under this model. Thanks. And I'm here because we have to build, if we're going to win in a global economy, if we're going to create a global economy that actually values working families and creates real security for people, we have to organize across borders. We have to be building relationships and solidarity and cooperation across regions, across borders, and putting forward a different vision than the one we've been living under for the last 30 years or so in the U.S. And I'm here because, you know, Ben Franklin said the definition of insanity is to do the same thing over and over again and expect different results. Right? Atlantica is just it's a rewarmed leftover version of NAFTA that wants to be intensified, you know, and we've been screwed on that, we've lost out on that. And so to simply, you know, put forward that model in a deeper form and expect different results is insanity. And that's not the path to go down, and we need to push against that. And I'm here because I fundamentally believe that if we work together, build cross-border alliances, we can defeat this, and we have to defeat this. We have to turn around this agenda and put forward an agenda that has our values at its core. You know, and I think, you know, all that said, you know, it's pretty clear when people relate to people, when folks sit down, that Maine, that Vermont, that New Hampshire, that this region of the northern U.S. and this region of Canada have a lot in common. I think there's a shared work ethic, there's shared values, there's a shared cultural history, and in a lot of ways, increased cooperation, increased people-to-people relations, increased economic relationships based on economic justice and real values would be a positive agenda. It's something that we should be talking about. What is our vision of that kind of cross-border cooperation look like? That's a path we should be going down. But as always, the devil is in the details. It's what are the rules? Who's going to benefit? Who's going to lose as a result? And when you look closely at Atlantica, or when you look closely at this larger agenda of deep integration, it's very clear that those are not values that the majority of people in Canada and the U.S. hold. It's very clear that that model of integration is a model that's going to fail the majority of people. And I think, you know, this whole question of Atlantica, when you look at the proposal and the emerging proposals very closely at all, it's clear that they're based on neoliberal corporate values, neoliberal corporate ideas, and about expanding a model that, you know, that really thrived on those ideas in NAFTA. And it's also clear that, you know, that it's part of this larger deep integration project. And the very language clearly implies, for Canadians, moving towards a U.S. economic and social model. And from someone who's been living in that model and working with people trying to push back on that model, I can say to you very clearly and emphatically that that is not the model that you want to be moving towards. That's not the model that you want to be integrating with. So, you know, let's just paint a quick picture of what you'd be integrating into, and deeply integrating for that matter. You know, the U.S. right now is 55 million people that have no health insurance, zero, zip. The emergency room is their health insurance in the wealthiest country in the world. You know, it's a moral tragedy. And another 55, 60 million who are grossly underinsured, right? Wages in the United States are at 1973 levels in terms of their real purchasing power. Right? There's this incredible stagnation of wages while corporate profits hit all-time highs. Poverty has increased for the last 4 years and is at record levels. Our country, as earlier speakers have talked about, is deeply, deeply indebted. Our trade deficit is hitting record levels. And there is a day of reckoning that's going to come. The reason the pain of stagnating wages hasn't been more serious is because we're living on cheap credit and foreign debt that's going to catch up with us and going to be a painful point of reckoning. You know, in a lot of ways, the U.S. right now is in a situation that the Soviet Union was in before it collapsed, right? Our military spending is through the roof. We're spending more than half of every dollar taxpayers pay goes to the largest military machine in the world. Meanwhile, our infrastructure is crumbling. We're not investing in people. We're not investing in bridges. We're not investing in roads. We're not investing in schools. We're not investing in the things that are fundamentally important. And we've seen that recipe of empire time and time again. When you put your money into military might, overextend yourselves, and don't invest in the basic fundamentals of a society, your society collapses, you know, in a variety of forms. And so that's the path we're on. Again, not one you want to deeply integrate with. You know, the list goes on. You know, we're Social Security, a fundamental, the most successful anti-poverty program in U.S. history. You know, it was on the chopping block. Was privatization of it was pushed back, thankfully, thanks to unions and allies and all the folks like you in this room who fought against that in the U.S. But that's the worldview that the folks who are pushing this model have, and that's what they're going after. Ecologically, you know, we're going down the exact opposite road of where we need to be going. You know, an ecological disaster that we're just ignoring and just blatantly, arrogantly disregarding its impact, its long-term impact, its impact on the rest of the world. And as everyone knows, you know, we have one of the most regressive, deceitful, arrogant administrations in history. And a larger worldview, that's what we talk about as a yo-yo worldview that's pushing this, right? You're on your own. Margaret Thatcher said, you know, in her vision of neoliberalism, there's no such thing as society. That's the direction these folks want to move the United States in and have been, you know, very successfully over the last 30 years. Again, not what you want to move towards. In that race to the bottom that's part of the global economy, we're winning the race. I don't think you want to join us, right? So, you know, it's a basic point. It's not the path you want to follow. It's not the path that the rest of the hemisphere is following. There's a strong, vibrant rejection of neoliberalism, of the Washington consensus, of the U.S. model of how to organize economies and nation states. And we need to be moving in a different direction from that. We need to be putting forward a different vision. And we're in fundamentally a different place in the U.S., right, than you are here. Here, I think you're fighting to preserve the social rights that have been won and trying to keep them as rights. In the U.S., we're trying to fight to turn things that have been commodified and turn commodities into a right. It's a hell of a lot harder to move something from a commodity back to a right, like healthcare. So don't lose that. Don't let it be taken away by deep integration, by NAFTA, by this agenda. You know, the U.S. has spent years trying to impose this model on the rest of the world, and done so, you know, with some success, some very bloody, violent, brutal success. But the world is also saying no. So that, you know, don't willfully step into that model. That's foolish and back to Ben Franklin's insanity. So, just to step back for a quick second here. You know, I think when we look more closely at Atlantica, it's very clear that it's, you know, it's based on a NAFTA plus, a NAFTA on steroids, if you will. you know, taking those, that set of rules, intensifying it, deepening it, expanding it. Most of the work that the coalition that I'm part of does in Maine is on trade issues, and it's about trying to turn around this agenda and turn around this U.S. trade policy. And I think, you know, I think it's important that we reframe the debate around trade, because I don't fundamentally think it's a debate about trade, right? As earlier speaker said, you know, trade has plenty of benefits when done well. But fundamentally, the agreements that U.S. capital pushed were about creating conditions, creating a set of rules, creating that slide where they can move production anywhere in the world to find the cheapest places of production, the places with the least environmental standards. Jack Welch, the former CEO of GE, said very blatantly and frankly, you know, ideally we'd have every one of our plants on a barge so we could move it to wherever we could find the cheapest cost of production. Right? Again, that's their yo-yo, you're on your own worldview. That's not our worldview. But it's also these trade deals have also been about creating a set of rules, a set of conditions, creating a global economy where corporations can slip out of a social contract, can slip out of the restraints and the victories that people fought and died for over a century of struggle. The trade policy that the U.S. government has been pushing is about rolling back the 20th century in our country, right? Because people fought and died for a weekend. People fought and died for an eight-hour day. People fought and died for basic protections on the job, for basic protections for the environment. And all of that is being rolled back. It's obviously not being rolled back solely by trade policy. Our trade rules are one piece of it that allows corporations, you know, to get out of a social contract, to move where they can, you know, lower standards and move away from that, and move away from those things that we fought for. And it, you know, as earlier folks have talked about, sort of this history of struggle that we inherit, this, you know, this ability to keep a struggle moving. We have to remember what kind of sacrifice people paid and what kind of responsibility that puts on our shoulders to move, you know, to not let those gains be lost. The second point in reframing the trade debate or the Atlantica debate is fundamentally to remember that it's a debate about rules. It's about what kind of rules are going to structure regional economies, what kind of rules are going to structure the global economy, who gets to make the decisions about them, and who wins and loses as a result. The globalizers, the corporate free traders, are very explicit. Renato Ruggiero, the former director of the World Trade Organization, said very bluntly, we're writing a single constitution for the global economy, right? These are enforceable rules. They have their own private courts for capital to enforce those rules. And although the U.S. often doesn't follow them, we do damn well insist that the rest of the world does and that they have some real teeth to them. And if, you know, if we look at our own history in the United States, we saw a constitution, a domestic constitution, that was written by the propertied class for the propertied class, and that constitution excluded everyone else. You know, it had no rights for people of color, no rights for women, no rights for very few rights for non-property owning males initially, right? And through a century plus of struggle, rights were put into that constitution. And the fact that the Constitution didn't have rights for other parties, for other actors, for other values, almost led to the disintegration of our country, right? A civil war was fought in the United States because they created a Constitution that didn't have rights or values for the majority as a core part of it. So when people ask me, you know, why were there 60,000 people out in the streets at the World Trade Organization? Why were there 70,000 people out in the streets at the G8? My answer is, you know, they're writing a Constitution for the global economy that doesn't have any of us at the table or doesn't have any of our interests at the core. That's a pretty serious problem. And so, you know, all constitutions have philosophical underpinnings. They have, you know, they have political, philosophical ideas that are at their basis. And when we look at, you know, the NAFTA model, the CAFTA model, the WTO model, it's a neoliberal constitution. It's a constitution built on the idea that there is no such thing as society, that the decisional body for all of us should be the unregulated free market, that a democratic state where we all participate and have a voice is a relic of the past and should be have its hands tied behind its back, that the only actors who are fit to make decisions and structure society are multinational corporations, and the only people who should be given rights are investors, right? That's not our vision for the world, and that's not the set of rules that we want. When you look at Atlantica, it's a regional replication of that model. It's trying to draft a set of rules, a set of policies that, you know, sound innocuous on on the surface who could be opposed to trade between Atlantic Canada and northern New England. That sounds great. You know, we'll throw in a little increased transportation. That sounds great, too. You know, we can do a little energy exchange. Nice idea. But, you know, let's scratch below the surface. If you look at the values, the ideas that are pushed behind this proposal, right, let's go to the Ames website, as far as I can tell here, the think tank that's most aggressively pushing this. You know, they say very clearly that this region suffers from poor quality public policy that holds Atlantica back and it needs to be reformed. What are those things? Minimum wage legislation is a poor quality public policy. Union density, right? Unions, the most effective anti-poverty program the world has seen, right? Those are a form of poor... That's poor quality public policy that needs to be reversed, undermined, scrapped through this deep integration regional model of NAFTA plus. You know, the size of government that works in the interest of people, size of government relative to the economy. That's a poor quality public policy. So we start to get the picture of what, you know, what they're after, what kind of values, what kind of ideas, what kind of rules are going to underlie this model of integration. There's also a lot of rhetoric about removing non-tariff barriers to trade. Again, it sounds nice. You know, what the hell is a non-tariff barrier to the trade? What the hell would it have to do with my life? But what it's really about is it's about all the things that we democratically work to put in place to raise up standards, to create meaningful environmental standards, to create meaningful public health standards, to create meaningful standards to promote food safety, meaningful protections on the job. All of those things they're not tariffs, but they're barriers to trade. So, you know, let's figure out a new way to axe that agenda, right? So that's what this is about. And it's really important that we also recognize that neoliberalism, you know, it fights on a lot of levels. It puts its agenda forward in a lot of levels, but it fights aggressively on the level of ideas, on the playing field of ideas, right? NAFTA was proposed in 1979 as a concept by Ronald Reagan, and it kicked around in think tanks and was honed and refined and given lots of these $600 dinners and ultimately became the law of the land. And so we have to take that contesting on the level of ideas very seriously and be putting out, you know, strong critiques of this and strong visions of what we want. A bit on the good news, just to talk about what some of your brothers and sisters to the south have been doing to try and push back on this agenda, because in the U.S., the only place where you can push progressive legislation and progressive reform right now is at the state level. We've been doing a lot of work to try and scrap this NAFTA model and put forward a new model in its place. We recently got our governor to take Maine out of the GATS agreement, the General Agreement on Trade and Services. Right, which is a tremendous victory because, you know, trade rules simply shouldn't be regulating what we can and cannot do with health care. Maine pulled itself out of our health care commitments in the GATS. They shouldn't be regulating land use and zoning decisions at the local and state level. They shouldn't be telling us what we can or cannot do in terms of funding public libraries, what we can and cannot do in terms of funding public education. That's not what a trade agreement is about, right? But for corporations, it is, because that's a tool and a means and a vehicle to put forward rules that states, local communities, and countries have to conform with. We created a Citizens Trade Policy Commission at the state level in Maine to give citizens a real voice in these issues, to look at all of the democracy issues, NAFTA's investment chapter, what it means for public policy, and a commission that holds public hearings throughout the states and amplifies the voice of citizens. Our governor, through a lot of good work of people in Maine, recently formed a governor's coalition on sweat-free purchasing and workers' rights to ensure that our taxpayer dollars, when we spend them, go towards making sure that people have basic decency and good working conditions and aren't supporting sweatshops. So, you know, I think that's a vision of the kind of... That's a vision of the kind of state work, regional model that we want to be moving toward. That's not a vision that Atlantica puts forward or espouses. I think the challenge for us, clearly, as we go ahead, is to figure out how to build, you know, deeper cross-border alliances. One of the challenges, right? The investor class is clearly very well organized on a global level, and they're writing global, regional, sub-regional rules that reflect their class interests, their agenda, their ability. Traditionally, we've fought on a national level, right? We've fought to make national markets more just, more humane, that they have a floor that things won't drop below, that they have some basic decency and dignity at their core. And we had a lot of, you know, we've had some success over a century plus of work in our respective countries, but you know, they've shifted the playing field. They're creating global market that doesn't have a set of rules, that doesn't have a social contract, that doesn't have anything to insist that there's a floor that nothing dropped below. So they're very well organized. You know, the Party of Davos is what it's being called in the U.S. that, you know, that meets, that crafts these rules, that puts forward these policies. We have to figure out, as we continue to intensify our struggles at the local and state level, how we also organize across borders to start putting forward policies that can start to bring some humanity and some decency and a human face to the global economy or to our regional economies, you know, whether it be Atlantica or any other region that's becoming increasingly integrated. And our economies are intertwined, you know, they're going to become increasingly intertwined. There's no getting out of that. So we need to build movements that have the power to shape how that happens and shape the questions about who wins and who loses, and that have the power to put forward a different model. And bringing it back to the U.S., I think it's really important to really make a distinction between people and governments. And this is sort of what I want to close on. You know, I think it's really easy to look at the state of our country and to just kind of dismiss the U.S. public as hopelessly lost and as just sort of a cruel, hopeless, lost public. And I think it's the furthest thing from the truth. The reality is that the majority of people in the U.S., and I think the great majority, know that something is fundamentally wrong. They know that something is off in our body politic, that something is rotten in Denmark, that something is just really soulless in how we're going about the world. But what they're fundamentally lacking is any hope. They don't believe that things can be different. They don't believe that people have the capacity to go out and change the conditions of their lives. And that is a difficult situation to organize in. People are living in a state of hopelessness. They're living in a situation of incredible fear, in large part because of the globalization conditions that have been pushed forward, where security has been pulled out from people, and they're really, you know, jobs and the economy is in a difficult place. And so I think our task before us is to figure out how to go forth and cultivate hope with people, cultivate a vision that's compelling enough to mobilize people and bring them forward, and cultivate a movement that's powerful enough to actually contest for power and move a different vision into reality, a vision that's based on joy and justice, on dignity and decency, on a strong democracy and a vibrant public engaged in the decisions that need to be made. So I urge all of us to go forth and to continue that good work and to build that solidarity to make that happen. Thanks.